and welcome along to the Tortoiseshack Sunday special, where we come together to break down the events of the week. And since I'm hosting, there may be some sex puns, which I will try and minimise, but no promises. Today, I'm joined by the host of Pack Woman podcast, which is Linda, the host of Police podcast, which is Vicky, the host of Echo Chambers podcast, which is Tony and Martin, and our new babies to the shack, which Jules for Conversate Trans, our delightful new podcast all about trans people interviewing trans people about their experiences. Go check it out. It is incredible and the lineup is absolutely amazing. So yeah, definitely drop a line and rate and review over on Apple if you really want to help out. That'd be great. So we're going to have a chat about the events of the week, which I don't even know what week it is, but we'll figure that out as we dive in. We'll have a live Q&A session for Patreons at the end, which can get a little bit rambunctious sometimes. If you'd like to join us next week, please pop over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. And not only do you get to join us for a bit of a Sunday morning laugh, you get to also support the work of the Tortoiseshack, as we're now up to around 50 podcasts a week, I think, with lots of plans for future content that is.
Did you see me get absolutely owned by Lynn on,
Senator Lynn Rand is right. Yeah. I looked at my inbox and it's all just Tortoiseshack.
We don't need an email per podcast.
I got absolutely owned. Slayed.
Yeah. Is a Tortoiseshack guide, so every Sunday produce the listings for the weekend.
More emails than Living Social.
Not a good thing.
I have to put that in my bio.
Jesus, no, that's not.
We will address the issue. Noted, Patreons.
We might get started. We have an amazing special guest with very fancy hair today, and she's here to talk to us all about what's going on up in Northern Ireland. Aoife Grace Moore, you're very welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Good. What is the story? How big of a question is that? Because there's a lot going on.
You have 800 years.
If we start maybe with what happened on the Ormore Road on Friday, it's got decent enough coverage down here, but could you maybe explain a little bit about what was going on?
Yeah, so basically there was an atrocity on the Ormore Road in Belfast a number of years ago at a bookies, Sean Graham's bookies. Basically, a paramilitary, UFF man, sorry, opened fire on a bookies in a Catholic part of Belfast and killed five people. And I correct me if I'm wrong, I think it's five people.
Yeah.
And injured a lot more. Yeah. And obviously, like everything else, there's now like a bit of a memorial there where the atrocity happened. And every year, you know, they go and leave flyers or whatever, like they would have, you know, Oma Bomb or Bloody Sunday or whatever. But obviously because of COVID, this year it's a lot smaller, the memorial. And a few survivors and family members of the people who died attended during the week to leave some flyers at the memorial. They were masked up, obviously it was outside. And when they got there, they were confronted with a number of PSNI officers who said this was against public health guidelines. You've probably seen someone recorded it and put it on Facebook and Twitter, but it kind of got out of hand really quickly. And one of the men who survived the terror attack was then arrested. It was actually the strangest thing about it, I thought, when you're watching the video, was that he had flyers in his hand. It was like such a weird kind of, I don't know, picture of like arresting someone with flyers in their hand. And he was, yeah, arrested and taken to the police station and kept there for a number of hours. His solicitor, Niall Murphy, brought him out a couple hours later and basically just said, you know, this is completely ridiculous and they'll be taking it further. And it's kind of caused this wider debate now about the PSNI and what, you know, I actually thought it was quite shocking that we saw the BBC, a journalist from the BBC saying, you know, this is really selective policing that we're seeing. So we kind of contrast this survivor leaving flyers to the footage we saw last week of mass men careering through East Belfast in this kind of show of strength. over Article 16 and the border on the Irish Sea and all that. And you saw that the kind of police that were there watched on. We saw, you know, the Bobby Storey funeral, which is hugely against public health guidelines. Police did very little of that as well. So, but in Derry, they arrested and fined Black Lives Matter protesters. So it doesn't seem that there is any kind of thread of how the policing works. And both, I find it quite strange now that both communities, loyalist and nationalist communities, feel that the police have an issue with their community. The chief constable has had numerous issues. It's a hard job, I totally understand that. But from the get-go, the chief constable has become mired in controversy. He is very clunky with his statements and the different photo ops he does. And Michelle O'Neill, the leader of Sinn Féin, doesn't seem that she wants to let this one go. She's not calling for him to resign. Many other people have. But there is a lot more that has to happen. The officers involved, as far as we're aware from the PSNI statement, were quite new to the job. One has been suspended and one has been moved to a different part of the PSNI or reassigned or however it works. But yeah, it's caused a wider debate now about policing and how people are policed, which is now a phrase I use because I listen to Policed.
But I think like this is a really big issue and it's something for us even down here to be really concerned with. Firstly, I mean, I think there's a whiff of scapegoating off what the chief constable did yesterday. Let's just blame the individual officers involved and not acknowledge in any way or reflect on there being a wider issue.
Yeah, there is actually an investigation ongoing and the point was made on the BBC this morning. I was watching Sunday Politics. They were saying it is actually even quite strange that they would suspend the officer straight away if there is this kind of investigation ongoing.
Yeah, it's very unfair and that's worrying. And it's like, it smacks to me of wanting to be seen to be have done something quickly. But that's very potentially unfair on the individual officer. But also like, and there is a bigger question and we're fingers crossed, Niall Murphy is going to do an episode of The Beat with me this week. He said he had, we're just going to try and find a time. But I think this is, as you say, it's a bigger issue and it's an ongoing thing. And like, what worries me about it is like, God, the patent reforms were amazing. No police force in the world had transformed the way the PSNI had. They had genuinely become one of the most human rights compliant police forces in the world. And for them to be slipping back this way in the midst of Brexit and all that could happen in the next few years and all this talk of border polls, like it's genuinely frightening. And it should be a big old warning sign for us about how, like even stuff like the policing board letting go of the human rights advisor for a year and all of this kind of crack. It's a very worrying trend.
Like, do you think that's because of Brexit though?
No. So what I think it is if you look back and with the executive, so what I would say is the executive collapsed for so long. And in the midst of that, the policing board wasn't sitting because half of the policing board, which is the equivalent of the policing authority, is made up of elected representatives. We don't have that down here. So the policing board couldn't sit. And they also did things like the human right. They have a human rights advisor who's like is so on top of everything and really watching everything. Like, we don't have a position like that down here. And her contract was let go because they said they couldn't renew it in the midst of that. And it's just basically the pedal got taken off oversight. We stopped having proper, strong, independent oversight, as independent as it was. And you know, with the foot off the brake, people just went backwards. Silence. I connect this to down here because I think, you know, I disagreed with the proposal in the Commission of the Future Policing because I think it's a backward step in terms of the policing authority. We should be making it stronger, not weaker. And this is what happens when you like let oversight slow down in any way, shape or form. So like, it's very worrying for me in that regard. And I'd be worried if I lived in the north right now.
Yeah, I think, you know, what people in this, like the South, probably don't get is I find, you know, there's widespread kind of admiration and trust in the Gardaí. In the North, you know, there's this notion of the big culty Gard. We don't really see the Gards the same. But I think in the North, like if I just even explain this, I think people are always shocked when I explain this. But, you know, to have trust in a police force is not something that comes very easy to certain communities in the North, and they see a kind of slip back would be really concerning. So I'm I would say I'm quite young compared to other people. And I went to school before and after the Good Friday Agreement. But when I was 5 or 6, you probably do it here as well, actually, they bring a policeman into primary schools with the dog, and they show you what the police dogs do, right? And when I was, that would seem like a nice day out. I think my boyfriend, he's Scottish, and he was saying, oh, that happened at their school too, and it was basically a good day at school or whatever. But in my community, in my primary school, if they were, when they were bringing the RUC in, they show people this is the dog, and it's just a nice day for the kids. They had to send a letter out to the parents to tell the parents that the RUC were coming in to do tricks with the dog. And the day the RUC came into school, a lot of children in my class did not go to school. Their parents kept them off school because they did not want normalization of the RUC, and they did not want their children around the RUC. And even now, we had a tragedy in our family before Christmas and got a PSNI liaison officer. And the liaison officer said to my cousin, whose son had just died, you know, a lot of, we have, you don't have to have us. The PSNI can do this at arm's length. We don't need you. If you're not comfortable having the police here, we can leave. And I don't think any other, you know, country that I can think of has a police force where you have to say, ah, oh, listen, like, we don't actually have to be here if you're not comfortable having us around, because that's how deep it goes in Northern Ireland. And any kind of rollback to what we had before is not good. It's not good for civilians. It's not good for government. It's not good for the people. And I would be really concerned that if a PSNI do not get their act together, we could see a slip back, and it's not good for anybody.
I think especially, like, given your tweet this morning, that was about two people being shot last night. So that's pretty concerning that's going
on. I mean, this is an ongoing issue in Craigan. Craigan's an estate in Derry. For anyone who doesn't know, it's a big Catholic estate to high levels of poverty. And there has been ongoing issues with dissident Republican violence for years. Dissident Republicans will always have a base of support in places like Craigan and the Bogside. And not about this particular case, but in general, what seems to be happening is it's to do with drugs. Dissident Republicans claim that they don't want drugs in these communities, and they carry out vigilante attacks on perceived drug dealers, whether they are or not, I don't know. But, you know, there's been Oscar-nominated documentaries made about this, and if anyone's seen A Mother Brings Her Son to Be Shot, I would recommend it. But that is very much the kind of vein that continues, and there doesn't seem to be any real action against it. When people are kneecapped in Derry, there very rarely seems to be, you know, anyone charged with it. It's rare that you would hear someone being charged for kneecapping someone. And it's 2021. You know, I could have had this conversation 40 years ago, and we're still having it now. So,
it's not just still, because, like, these two issues are inextricably linked, because the less people trust the police, the more they go to paramilitary groups to perform these punishment beatings or to deal with perceived offenders. So, like, if trust in the police slips back, this is what you're looking at, even more of this.
Yeah, exactly. The issue would be, if you're going to be kneecapped, you know you're going to be kneecapped. And a lot of times people will present themselves to be kneecapped. In any other state, you could go to the police and say, someone wants to kneecap me. And that's the issue that we're having in these communities, is that they don't think about going to the police. And a lot of instances, they'll just either go over the border or just wait and see what happens. But the police very rarely play a role in the first instance.
So now I'm really looking forward to hopefully talking to Niall during the week and getting into a bit more detail on this.
Thanks, Mel. If that it's just slightly terrifying that may be an option, especially, I suppose, with Brexit stuff going on and maybe Scotland's push for independence, and then the impact that has in the north, and then the mess that is generally kind of around that aspect. So sure, look, we'll have you back on, because I'm sure this is not going away anytime soon, unfortunately. But thank you so much for this morning.
No problem.
We might move on to a slightly different topic, but still one that's very frustrating, is the issue of zero COVID and how the government is kind of responding to that. So we have Simone George coming on, who's one of the leaders of the We Can Be Zero campaign. And I think she's around.
I am.
You are around. Hey, good morning. Hey. How are you?
Hi, I'm great. Thank you. Thanks for thanks for having me on.
Cool. So where are we at the moment for the push for zero COVID?
Well, we're still pushing and we're in the process of gathering many more people to put their shoulder to that wheel. So a couple of weeks ago, I contacted ISAG, the Independent Scientific Advocacy Group, who've been calling for a zero COVID strategy, or what they were saying early last summer, to crush the curve rather than just flatten it, which means aiming at saving lives and getting Ireland opened up internally, ultimately would be the aim. And I suppose personally, I've been watching them while dealing with transferring to fully working at home. I'm a practicing solicitor. The courts have been closed and working remotely or open in some areas, but all of that. And also in the first 2 weeks of lockdown last year, my mom, who had cancer, ended up back in St. Vincent's and we were locked out. So the first 2 weeks of lockdown, when everything was in a panic, we were watching her deteriorate over FaceTime. And so early on, when I was looking at what ISAG were saying and what other people were saying and what New Zealand was doing and South Korea and these other countries around the world that went for an elimination strategy rather than just suppression, this idea of we could live with COVID, I thought this is going to be a done deal. This makes total sense, especially when Irish people so successfully got the numbers down last summer. And I was in the grieving, I suppose, of that, and also thought somebody else is doing this. So a few weeks ago, when I realised we were heading into lockdown three, and the only plan in lockdown three, it seemed, from the government were lockdowns 4, 5 and 6, I got incredibly frustrated and contacted ISAG. And out of that has come this We Can Be Zero, which is the people's campaign. So we launched on Monday on St. Bridget's Day, and in a really short period of time, over 50,000 people have interacted with the campaign, have either subscribed, joined us, followed us online, and started to, you might have seen, we were trending for a day. People were messaging Micheál Martin saying, I've done my bit and I'm doing my bit to get the numbers down, but you have to keep up your side of the bargain. You have to keep the numbers down, which is a proper public health intervention at a local level. And we can talk about that if you like, and to keep it out. So a mandatory hotel quarantine. And then all of the efforts and sacrifices Irish people have made for the last year and will continue to make when it makes sense for them, the government have to do their part.
Yeah, it looked very like this week, like Micheál Martin has come out in the Mail today and said, we made a mistake. Now, it is the royal we. It's not just that government have made a mistake. But then 7 days ago, you had Leo Varadkar saying that we will have staycations again this year. So they only really admit to a mistake when they're about to make another. And my gut feeling on this is that they are looking at opening up with numbers in and around, or even in excess of where they opened up the last time. There are no lessons learned. We are heading straight back into another lockdown. I don't know how we get past this. The public opinion is very much on the side of zero COVID, and yet you have a government that's not hearing the public opinion, or choosing not to hear the public opinion. It very much goes to show that the lack of the ability to have direct action is impacting the way this virus is going in this country. Government just aren't under enough pressure.
That's a really useful analysis of it, actually, Martin. I didn't see the Mail this morning. I think that's what we need to do. So a few people I talked to over the last few days said, oh, it's great, the campaign's going really well, but they're going to do this. You know, this is in the bag, they're going to do this. They won't admit they've made a mistake. They'll just call it something else, not zero COVID. They'll call it something else, and they'll move us towards that. And I think that's a really dangerous thing to be thinking right now. I think political will's this thing that everyone talks about, but it's not really defined, and we don't really know what it is. But I understand it as a critical number of people in the power to make these changes thinking a particular way. And that always comes from the people. And you're right, we can't march in the street because we're doing the right thing to not kill our grandparents and make our children sick and to overload the frontline workers. So we have to do this digitally. So we were talking about the launch on Monday as a digital march, and there will be further opportunities for people to gather in this public meeting way. We're planning one for Valentine's Day, which is a Sunday, and for people to bring their ideas to volunteer to the campaign if they want to come and join it in a really practical way and give a bit of time and their excellent expertise. But we need to say that this is what we want. We're wasting this lockdown right now because we're not plugging the leaks the other side.
The CMO did say during the week that we'll have to get down to single numbers like we did in the first lockdown. But that begs the question, why would you stop when you're 10 days away from having zero COVID?
Well, why not keep them down? So my understanding, so I'm not a scientist, just to be clear about that. So my understanding is as a non-scientist who's been listening to what they've been saying is to get the numbers to single digits is where we should be aiming, and not thinking of this lockdown or the last, what ideally in with a zero COVID aim, this would be the last lockdown to get numbers to single digit numbers. That's because then local well-resourced public health teams can deal with small clusters that pop up without having to close the entire country and everything down. But aiming for those numbers, that's the right way to do it, rather than saying 4 weeks, 6 weeks, 3 months, it's to get to those numbers. But then you have to have those other things in place. So you have to have public health properly resourced. I understand fewer resources have gone towards public health this year than last year. And again, you'd have to talk to someone like Gabriel Scally about really understanding that, or Mary Cassidy, people who work in that field. And then you have to keep it out. So these half-hearted quarantine at home, is that isolating? How do you stay away from your family if there's more than one of you that lives in the house, you know? And none of this now is new or difficult to figure out, because there are other countries around the world. My cousin just came home from Singapore, where they do mandatory hotel quarantine. And there's also an option to quarantine at home. If you live alone, you have a landline. They ring you 4 times a day on the landline. You can miss one call. But if you miss the other three, somebody comes and knocks on your door to see why you're not at home. And if you can't do that, you don't have a landline, you don't live alone, you can't isolate within your house with the other people, you must go to the hotel quarantine. And they've been really successful in keeping this down. So there's a huge amount that Irish people can do and have done, but they now need to say to Micheál Martin, we need you to do your bit. And then we will be great. You know, the reward at the end of this is hopefully no more people dead from COVID. The numbers are appalling. No more people like me and so many of my friends now who are planning these, you know, funerals. People are watching on webcams in churches, and you can't, you know, you can't properly support each other. I mean, people are really, really suffering. And it's so that, as Leo Varadkar said on Claire Byrne last week, well, someone might want to go to an interview in London.
Mm. Can I just say, in terms of the kinds of things that we're seeing, we're seeing an increase of cases on domestic violence. We're seeing an increase of cases of people looking for therapy supports. We can't get solicitors and we can't get therapists because they're under too much pressure. Even if we're willing to pay for these services, then we just can't get them because there's a rise in domestic violence. There's a rise in issues with co-parenting. There's a rise in sexual violence. There's a rise in the amount of people who need PTSD and therapy supports, and we just can't get them to them people. And the government haven't put any extra, they talk about mental health and the effect of lockdown on mental health, but not implementing zero COVID is having that same impact. The thoughts of these lockdowns rolling is having the same impact on mental health as being in lockdown and coming out of lockdown too early and having to go back in. So there isn't any will there, and we talked about political will, and I know that's, you know, but there is no investment. We're not seeing the investment into the services, but like we're not seeing the investment into zero COVID.
But it's not
sorry, Vicky,
like it's not even investment, it's about attitude, right? Because like even now the way they're talking about quarantine, they were so reticent to get there, and then when they do get there, they do it in such half measures. And like, what message is that sending to anyone, you know? And like, we see these people's piece in the Independent this morning about how people are literally, like, you know, the middle class and wealthier are just literally adding the fine on as part of their cost of their holiday, you know, because that's what government have said. Like, fines are ridiculous. It's not an effective deterrent. It just criminalizes poor people. Mm-hmm. And so, like, that's the tone coming from the top. That's the leadership we're getting. And no, like, this is not a quarantine system that has been introduced. It's a half-hearted measure as a sop to try and shut people up, but we have to make sure that it doesn't.
It's also an obsession with enforcement, which is the wrong way to look at it altogether, because in fact that investment in, Linda knows I work in domestic violence and public policy around domestic violence and in my practice, and aiming for zero COVID, so adopting that strategy would resolve those problems. So domestic violence has always been a social issue. But when communities are open, they support each other. So victims have somewhere to go, and perpetrators are policed by their families and by their friend groups, and, you know, people witness it happening, the neighbour's able to go in. All of those things function in society, and they're not functioning now. So people's lifelines have been cut off. So as much as I've had calls over the last year where people need the Gardaí to intervene and they won't go in because there's a COVID risk, or it's not clear what sort of order the person has. This is for people who are already in the system. What they're really missing is the ability to go and stay with to take the child, to go and stay with the mother, because the father has insisted on sitting with his finger on the doorbell unless the child's handed over. And they're saying, well, do I risk staying at home with this person with the finger on the doorbell and the child traumatized? Or do I go and stay with my parents and risk giving them COVID because I'm I mean, they're putting people in horrific life-threatening situations so that someone can go to an interview in London. And I can't get my head around that anymore. Especially Micheál Martin, you know, when he was health minister, brought in the smoking ban. And I don't know if any of you remember, before that, we were all really pleased with ourselves to sit in pubs with overflowing ashtrays, and whether we were smoking ourselves or not. And if you had a party at home, you'd put ashtrays out and people would smoke in your house. And because of that, to protect people in their place of work, nobody does that anymore when they have a party at home. In fact, people I know who smoke don't smoke inside their own house. Even when they're on their own, they go outside. If you show people the right way, they will do the right thing for their health, for their community, for their family. And you don't need to have fines and enforcement. That's for Yeah.
Just on the thing, just one point on okay, so everybody, it's wecanbezero.com. Absolutely go, get involved. You'll find them on Twitter, at wecanbezero. Grace Dias is also involved. I was at the launch. It was really, really well attended. It was really well laid out. There's a brilliant video you can watch. We can all get involved. But on that crucial point about the smoking ban, we spoke to Dave Gibney the other night, and he pointed out that just in terms of bar staff, they've already shown that it's saved over 5,000 lives. That band, wow. and he's involved with Mandate Trade Union, and they've had their economic people look at it and say, well, what were we looking at in terms of staff? Never mind the individuals who are smoking, what lives were saved just in terms of bar staff? 5,000 lives. Sorry, Caroline, I know you.
No, you're great. No, but that really puts it into perspective on that. So, we'll move on. But I suppose I just wanted to say people in the comments are saying, yeah, this lockdown particularly is really hard on mental health. But I think it's going to start coming up on things like Facebook memories soon, you know, and you're going to remember, Jesus, it's actually been a year. Like, so I think at the moment when you're just kind of going day to day, but when you're bombarded with what life was like before. And I think with my viral tweet about the Easter, the Great Wall of Easter eggs in Tesco, people were quote tweeting that, but putting next to it the pictures of New Zealand with their massive concert that they had. So we're still deciding clothes aren't essential, and New Zealand is having a great time with massive concerts and just the massive comparison. So yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Everyone pop over and check out the We Can Be Zero campaign. Absolutely.
And just on the New Zealand example, it's become this sort of apocryphal, weird, you know, well, we're not New Zealand response. Somalia, Singapore, the Atlantic bubble in Canada, all of the issues with the border, and another time we could talk about the North, and ISAC have plans for how to deal with that. There are places that have managed to do this that do not have the geographical advantages that we have, and such cohesive communities in Ireland. We could really be the light shining to the rest of Europe and across the Atlantic to our people in America who are really suffering. We could really do this, and it could be great.
Absolutely. Listen, thanks Emil, Simone, for coming in. That's
thanks for having
hopefully
me.
We will get there sooner rather than later, but I just want to move on to over to Linda and the disgrace that we've seen this week, whereas we've seen multiple perpetrators of sexual violence buying their way out of jail this week.
Yeah, so we've had two cases of sexual violence and one case of serious assault where the perpetrators. So the first guy was Nurdin Balarbi, who got away with a €100 fine for sexually assaulting two women in a pub. And then we had Gavin Gallagher, who's from a good family, apparently. And that's why he got away with seriously assaulting a woman to the point where she was unrecognizable. And he paid 10,000. He was ordered to pay another 10,000 on top of the 6,000 he'd already paid her for dental work due to the fact that he had done it. And then yesterday we had a bar owner in Cork fined 15,000 for sexually assaulting a member of staff. And we don't know who that is and what bar that is. I would love to find out if anybody knows. And this guy was trying to blame it on the victim initially. So had recorded him apologizing to the victim generally just for the whole misunderstanding. So we have a case here where there's three examples from this week. And I will point out that Gavin Gallagher from Donegal, this is actually his second time to escape jail because he's from a good family. The first time he paid a taxi driver a week's wages for assaulting him in a taxi on the way home from a night out with his girlfriend. He was with his girlfriend again when he assaulted this woman. And there is a case pending that the district court refused to take. They said that the assault was too severe that he perpetrated. This guy from a good family perpetrated. That the district court refused to take it. It was too severe. They've passed it up to the circuit court in Longford. So we're waiting to see what's happening with that. What is going on with the justice system in this country?
What's really key there is that the fact that he had no previous convictions was one of the reasons why he got fined this time. And I think, like, this for me, we're straight back into Seamus Walsh territory. I know I'm obsessed, but like, it's all about how we regulate account, hold to account, train. There is no judicial training in this country. They have occasional conferences, but we have no judicial training. We have finally, in the last 6 months, have a sentencing guidance committee has been set up. So for the longest time, the judges have said, no, judicial independence means that you can't tell us what are advisable sentences, you know, kind of ranges that we might have in place. The legislation says maximums, maybe sometimes minimums, but that's it. You can't tell us anymore. So we now finally have a sentencing guidance committee, which has academics, a couple of judges and a few others on it. And they will be starting to draft up plans to talk about advisable sentences for different offences. But like, this is, I mean,
what I want to know though,
when was the sentence advisory committee set up in the UK? It must be nearly 20 years ago. Like, it's, yeah.
My big issue here is this good family thing. Okay. What?
Nonsense.
So if, for example, my brother was potentially a drug addict, okay, and had had a lot of brushes from the law, would that make me from a bad family? Would that mean that I would get a harsher sentence?
Yeah, I mean, we've had this on Police. We had the teenagers in Donegal whose brother, who does not live with them, has had a lot of drug issues with the guards, and they get targeted by the guards because of their brother. So absolutely, people whose families have had encounters with the guards are treated differently.
And I want to know, so how does this judge know he's from a good family? How connected are the family? Like, how do they know that? What's the measurement? Is it that they're elected reps? Is it that they're political donors? Like, where is that coming from?
Yeah, I mean, that's a moral judgment of good, right? Yeah.
It reminds me of that guy who went down either for sentencing or for the court, and everyone lined up to shake his hand. Mm-hmm. And he was a rapist. And I think even the priest shook his hand as well, because he was, again, from a good family.
There was another case in Waterford back in 2014 where when the police knocked on this guy's door, he opened the door and he said, "I raped her." And he pleaded guilty, and he got 7 years with the last two suspended because he was from a good family and also because he'd had a couple of drinks.
Oh my God.
So I'm sick of this good family thing. Yeah. I'm sick of people being able to buy. Well,
can I come in? I know it's not the same. I just want to make the point that it was very, because it was a great statement I thought by Ian Wright this week about the judge who forgave his abuser, and he said it's not his forgiveness to give. And you know, we have to see this all the time where the abused has to be seen to absolve the person who prosecutes. And it's similar whether you want to talk about it within a patriarchal system or also within a I'm going to use that word again, caste system, where we outline people by the color of their skin. And I find, you know, when you see a judge, Shane, making a comment like that this week, and then Ian Wright saying no, it's not his it's not your place to say that he's learned his lesson or he, you know, he was young or he was this, and can't we all just hug it out, was basically the agenda. And I remember that Carolyn, it was the local GAA manager, the most respected one, shook their hand. We've seen cases where some of the top people in the GAA have actually written character references for people who are, you know, I know this guy, so pillar of the community.
Irish rugby team captain going along to give a character.
Oh no, Freel writing a reference for a convicted paedophile. So,
but there's a flip side to that coin, which is known to the Gardaí. And that's flip side of that coin, where somebody is killed and known to the Gardaí means, you needn't worry about them. You know, that's really what the flip side of that means. So do away with both phrases. We don't need either.
Yeah, and get rid of this buying your way out of jail. Nordin Bellarbi apparently has PTSD so bad from being in the Algerian army. And that was, you know, a defense for, and he got away with €100 fine for assaulting two women, 50 quid each. Like, it's 150 quid if your dog shits on the footpath. So like, excuse me if I'm really angry about this, but I am. And this poor box thing has to stop. We got rid of the poor box. You can't buy your way out of jail. You have to do your time, as far as I'm concerned. If you've done it and it has happened, and even the amount of suspensions that are happening as well.
But it's judicial training, judicial misconduct, sentence guidance, like all this stuff that should have been in place 30, 40 years ago. Like that's the answer to this.
We might move on to, I suppose, more money, but in a different kind of aspect, the PAC committee. Vicky, where are we going with that this week?
So it seems members of the PAC committee who wanted to question how the new Secretary General of the Department of Health was approved at a salary of, is it 250,000 or higher?
No, it's nearly 300,000.
Yeah, I think it's 289.
Yep.
289. And so members of the PAC committee, the Public Accounts Committee, wanted to look into that and have been told that if they did so, they might be overstepping their mark. And they've apparently received a full warning letter. So now we can't have any public accountability for decisions to throw so much money at a Secretary General role. Which is, I'm sure Martin has a few comments just once the word PAC comes up at all, but
I've been sort of tic-tacking with the PAC for a while, and my impression is since they've changed the rules, it's pretty pointless. You have a couple of minutes to make a statement at the beginning, and then people who do the questioning are absolutely gelded by the new rules that are put in place. It's not a public accounts committee. It can't hold the public to account, or it can't hold the state to account anymore. It's unable to do so. So we need to move on to a fresh vista, a new way of doing this. Public accounts is now, you know, mothball it, get rid of it. It's no use the way it is. Absolutely none.
One of the senior TDs who we spoke to recently told us that the only thing that the service that they get from the PAC at this stage, and fairly senior in the PAC, is being able to actually hold it up and say, this is what's happening. This is it, honestly. This is what has happened here. But there's no follow-up. There's no powers of actually, unless it catches the public zeitgeist, it catches the public mood, there's no actual accountability. And they said they've used this opportunity. The stuff is in the public domain, but because they just see people say, well, it's gone into the PAC, it's almost like going in, doing, you know, giving your little account of yourself and then walking out the door knowing, glad that's over. You know,
I don't know. I mean, PAC had completely overstepped its mark. It was political grandstanding, tearing civilians to shreds. Like, there's no doubt about that. Like, it had to change how it behaved.
Yeah, but they still don't
so far.
But there's still no. But like, I mean, we can go to several cases recently where we spoke to the whistleblower Noel McGree himself, and that case was raised, and they literally sat in there. The people who were called to account for what happened to Noel just said, "Oh, we weren't prepared for that. We don't have an answer for that. We'll get back to you for on that." And they did their 90 minutes and they walked out the door, and it was BAU for them. So the individuals involved have actually said to us, "We don't know if we're really making a difference."
Where in Irish society do we do accountability well? Like
nowhere.
No.
Okay, we don't.
We hold people, individual people, to account.
We don't do accountability. There is no forum in the state for somebody to go in and tell their story from start to finish. It doesn't exist within the state. Big point with me, because it doesn't exist. There's nowhere I can go to tell a whistleblower story, or any whistleblower can.
If you do, like, there are spaces where people can talk, but what happens on the back of it? Like, what do we mean by accountability? What does it mean to hold someone to account?
There isn't a space where somebody can talk. We really have to get that very clear. The space
for
does
the
not... But there is no official space where a person can go and tell the story. No. It doesn't exist.
No.
It simply doesn't exist.
It gets mediated to, like, the nth degree.
It gets separated and passed out and parsed, and you never get to tell your full story, ever.
Yeah. Like, we can look at that every which way. You talk to the people I have on police, like the people Linda works with, whistleblowers. You look at, like, everyone we've been talking today, you know, the Magdalene mother and baby home survivors, like, everywhere, every which direction. We do not know how to do accountability, and it's a really big conversation we need to have in this country.
I don't think it's necessarily us, the people. I think it's the people we elect.
Simone, do you have a comment? Sorry.
Well, that example, I think we don't understand restorative justice. We only understand justice as the legal system and then policing that part of it. And we don't understand how proper truth and reconciliation works, how that was done in South Africa. Like, even when it's flawed, it's kind of like zero COVID. Even if it's not going to be perfect, you're at least aiming for something that is restorative, that is good for the victim and is hopefully also good for the perpetrator. And then it's the same with Magdalen Laundrie, with collective trauma, with collective wrongs like that. You know, I don't want to live in a country that takes these women's testimonies and then destroys them. I mean...
But like, you also look at Micheál Martin during the week, and he was asked in the Dáil about truth and reconciliation from the North and supporting proper mechanisms to establish that. And he just plays politics and bats it back so disrespectfully, saying, well, you know, you're in Sinn Féin, you could do something about that. You're the Taoiseach. Mm. Like, you are the Taoiseach. Sort it. And don't like turn victims' suffering and agony into a political game.
Just on restorative, just on restorative justice, Ireland have launched the website this week. Check it out.
Perfect. We'll leave that there because I know we're going to come back to that in the Q&A for Patreons, because there's a lot of comments flying in around this topic. So I suppose just to wrap up, Tony, you're the Land Development Agency, a quick...
Just very quickly, we saw this week the bill is coming. It's going to be the second stage very quickly. Dara O'Brien has basically, depending on what side of the fence you sit, it's an anti-democratic grab where they're taking the land that is in state ownership and they're going to give it to the LDA so they can give it out to private developers to build for social and affordable housing. Now, the caveat there is, as Dara O'Brien and myself had this row on the phone, he said, oh, we're gone from 30% up to 50%, you know, what will be public and what will be private, and we go from there. That's a fair point. It's better than Owen Murphy's bill. But Owen Murphy's bill was a disaster. So, you know, tweaking a disaster and making, it's like heading towards an iceberg and saying, well, we slowed down before we hit it. So, but we sunk more slowly. I do think we are going to be coming back to it on the podcast this week, actually. I've spoken to both, as I said, the Minister for Housing and Owen O'Brien and a few others. So we will be coming back to it on the pod. But I do think the LDA, people forget the LDA was set up as a quango, another quango, to keep stuff off balance sheet and outsource our resource that we had, which was land. We have bountiful amounts of land. I think it's enough land amongst the Dublin County Councils to build 144,000 units. And we're going to blow it all away to private developers who will charge, on average, about 183,000 more per unit that they're going to deliver, and many of them for but bite the rent. We've a lot more to do on it. We've a lot more to cover. But the idea that this is better than Owen Murphy's bill, that's true. But Jesus, we can do a lot better than that.
It's anyway. A low bar, Tony.
Yeah. The bar was very low. So yeah, I'll leave it there.
We leave it there because I know yourself and Martin will come back to that anyway during the week and have many, many future discussions on that, because I don't think it's going away soon. We'll wrap things up there and we'll dive into
Hero of the Week Q&A
after our Hero of the Week. I wasn't forgetting this time. I actually did really well. I didn't forget. Our Hero of the Week, I'll start with you then, Linda.
I am going to nominate Lindsay Bennett, who managed to settle on the cervical smear check this week. Every one of those women are heroes, and there's no way they should be going to court to sort this out. But she was exceptionally brave and she was exceptionally articulate. And I'm just glad that she has the resources now to leave to her family to make sure that they're well looked after. But it shouldn't happen to be like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Vicky, your Hero of the Week.
Not just because they're here. Simone and Grace, the we can be zero is no, but it's a really important and it shouldn't be necessary, this kind of social movement. So it's incredible that two people, just like, you know, two ordinary people just stepping up. Well, not that they're ordinary, because obviously they're amazing, but you know what I mean? Like, it's, you know, they're just stepping up and doing it for the benefit of all of us. So totally heroes.
Martin?
I'm going to go with Barry McGuigan. I think Barry McGuigan did something very brave this week. It's one thing to stand up to a government who only think they're gangsters. It's a totally different thing to stand up to people who actually are gangsters. So I give it to Barry McGuigan. I think that was a very brave move from Barry.
And Jules, your Hero of the Week.
I haven't said anything because I'm just looking out of my chat, but I would like to just say to Tony, but I guess he'd be our Hero of the Week for helping us with the podcast.
No, we're not having that.
No, it's not allowed.
Already like this.
He wants to be hero of the week every
no.
week.
Do you know what? Okay. No. Jules.
You give it to him once a year.
Sorry for rounding on you like that.
No, Jules, don't. Let's not go. What we will say is that you guys are my heroes of the week, because when Caroline suggested the podcast to me, it was, as you know, it was completely outside of my comfort zone. But working with you guys has been terrific. To see it doing so well in the charts has been terrific. Yourself and Alex are doing great work. I know Lilith has been involved. I know Eilish has been involved. And I know, look, as I say to people, go check out the Starlings Collective. They're doing brilliant stuff. See Tenny for more. And Jules, thank you so much for trusting us to bring it out into the world. It actually does mean a lot to us that we managed to help put it out, and it's in the world now, and I think we've got three more episodes ready to go already, so I'm excited for people to hear it, and you guys are doing great work, so you're the hero of the week, not me.
Well, we're delighted to have you as part of the family.
Welcome aboard. And my hero of the week is Evan Rachel Wood, who came out and named Marilyn Manson as her abuser, and then that empowered other people to come forward and share their stories as well. And who knows what else that will come forward with, but obviously a scary thing to do, but you know, an amazingly empowering thing to do. So that is us.
She forgot Martin.
I forgot Martin. No, I didn't.
No, you got me. Barry McGuigan. You weren't even listening.
I forgot Martin.
You weren't even listening to me, Vicky. You weren't even listening.
All the time about forgetting that, and I managed it all. So, you know, yeah, no stress.
Thanks, Vicky. Thanks.
We're grand. We're going to go into our Q&A section now, which is live for our patrons. If you want to join us next week, please do pop over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. And like we said, it really does, like, you know, help keep the mics on and, you know, enable us to bring new podcasts such as Conversatrans into the mix. So thank you so much to all our patrons, and we will now have our little Q&A section.